I think it was Nafis who asked yesterday whether you can put Ubuntu on your machines. Just as Joy from IT made it clear the first day, you can, but then you'll lose the support of IT. So basically, they'll only, the image that they've put on your computer, which is a window, that's the only thing they're going to support. So if you put on, if you wipe that clean and put on Ubuntu or something, you do so at your own risk. And there is an Ubuntu virtual machine in there if you want to muck around. But you guys all got the email about Mathematica, right? Has anyone installed it yet? You have to watch some video or something, right? And then you get to download the...
They need to send something off and they confirm it.
Sorry?
They need to sort of confirm your status and then they said they'd get back to us in about 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks?
Like within 2 weeks. So I don't know.
Okay, I'll look into that. Okay, so let's start. So just repeat what I said a few minutes ago. Their first tutorial will be today at 2 o'clock in the Sci workroom. So it'll be two tutorials in a row. Well, the first one will be complex analysis. The second one will be algebra, okay? Okay, so today we'll start with complex functions. And there are many ways of defining complex functions, and one of them is just to define them explicitly. So what do we mean by a complex function? A complex function basically is a map from some open neighborhood of the complex plane into the complex plane itself. And you'll often see complex functions which are defined explicitly. For example, this is a complex function. And it blows up at the origin, so it's defined on the complex plane except at the origin. So more interestingly, you can actually take real functions and kind of analytically extend them to the complex plane. And for example, the exponential, so this is one example. Another example would be the exponential function. So, and this is defined in terms of the series. So, this would be 1 plus z squared, factorial 2, goes on and on. So it's, because some of the proofs in complex analysis depend on proofs or results from real analysis, right? So because in some sense, complex analysis is a restriction on some of the results on real analysis. So it's useful to think of complex functions in terms of real functions. Not always, but sometimes. So, you'll see often the complex function written in terms of two real functions, say u, and their functions of x and y being the real and imaginary part of z, and plus I, w, it's usually v, okay. And because the algebra of complex numbers is so nice, you can always do this. It's always possible to do this. Right. So less often you'll see functions like this, say, and you'll see why. So suppose z plus z bar. I mean, in principle, this is also a complex function. But we'll see that these sort of functions, which involve both z and its conjugate, they are not the nice kind of complex functions. More often, you'll see things like this, or almost exclusively. you know, you'll see things like e to the power I z. And because this is defined in terms of its series, we basically call this, you know, cosine of z. Sorry? No. There's an I in the exponential. Yeah. If there were no I's in the exponential, then. So this is the kind of thing that we are interested in. And so for example, you know, so this is an often used trick, is that you have some real functions defined in terms of a series, then you analytically extend it to the complex plane. But there's a little subtlety here, because you know, you can think of the real function cosine of x Oh, so you were right. Yeah, sorry, that wasn't, because.
No,
it's fine. Yeah. So. Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. It's all related to the Euler formula, right? so, you know, so for example, we can think of this as, you know, the domain as being on as a circle, right? And we can always embed the circle on the complex plane as well, you know. But to actually extend it to the whole complex plane from a circle, it's better to think of this function as, you know, a function defined on the real line, as a periodic function. And then, you know, we can just replace x by z, and then we get that function. If we had done, because, you know, on a circle, z takes the value e to the power I theta on a unit circle, right? So if you, so here is a picture. See, if this is a unit circle on the complex plane, the value of z on this circle is just given by this. So we could have just said, okay, this is, we could have identify this whole thing as z, but then this would be z bar. And then, you know, then we wouldn't have any good reason to call this cos of z, cosine of z, because, you know, this wouldn't have, on all of the complex plane, this would not coincide with what we understand as the series expansion, of course. So. You probably all know this, but, you know, but just in case. So more interestingly, the class of functions that you define by the inverse of this, you know, taking the inverse of these functions, they're a little bit more interesting. Well, these are, of course, interesting. They're more interesting because they have branch points and they have, you know, they involve the logarithms and things like that. We already saw these, so we have seen these two functions. Now, the inverse function of this guy is, you know, something that we talked about yesterday, is the square root of z, and this has a branch point at zero, and the inverse of this is there's an I here. So where small arg of z is it's a multi-valued object. So I could have written that as okay. So I'm not going to write out the list. There's a list here of the inverse sine, cosine, tan, all the inverse circular and the, you know, hyperbolic the hyperbolic functions. And they kind of all involved, you know, some complicated expression with inside a logarithm. Let's just work out one of them just for kicks. And so this is something. Incidentally, these. So let's work out what is the sine hyperbolic. What is the sine hyperbolic inverse of the sine hyperbolic? So we have sine hyperbolic of z is okay. Let's just first say this is the expression for the sine hyperbolic inverse of sine hyperbolic. Or well, how do you say this sinh, right? So do you say so I know sine h is sinh, right? And what's the inverse? Is there like a
arc sinh?
Yeah, that's better. Okay, let's say call it this arc sinh. So before you know we derive this formula, let's just you know we'll talk more about this in the tutorial. But this has very interesting. Although there's a logarithm, there is you know the branch point on the finite part of the complex plane. There are two branch points. And the two branch points come from the fact that there's a square root inside. So the branch points of this on the finite part of the complex plane are at plus I and minus I. And you can show that the and that's because the argument, if you set it to zero, you get an algebraic equation. That equation doesn't have any solution on the finite part of the complex plane. And therefore, you know, although the log function, log of z, has a branch point at the origin, the in arc sinh of z doesn't have the infinitely, you know, sheeted Riemann surface structure at the origin. It does so at infinity. And that's something, you know, we'll talk about more in the tutorial. Yes, Saad?
Would the branch points like the center move around because there would be a W or omega left?
What do you mean move around?
As in this yesterday we were taking basically a trip around the central circle, central point,
yeah.
Which was zero yesterday. But here, would it shift because there's still an W that is left even after the square root?
Oh, right. No, I mean. So the branch point is really just the branch points on the finite part will just be, you know, determined by this. Okay. And because you know this guy has this guy will you know around those points omega equals to plus I and minus I, you know, this guy will be well behaved if you go around once. If you go around once here, this guy will basically have to go around twice. Okay? So the branch point at infinity is more exotic, and you know, I don't think I actually I understand it, but you know, but we'll discuss more about it in the tutorial. Okay. So you know, just see how this sort of things come about. So this is the definition. So let's introduce. I'll try to avoid writing here because it's kind of. This should be pushed a little bit over there. But I don't want to do it because last year the string theorist lecturer, he basically destroyed the thing. The what do you call those things?
Podium.
Sorry.
The podium.
Podium, yes. The podium that's I think in the Sci room. Was actually over there and crashed. So I don't want to do the same thing. Probably costs more than me, so. So if I define Q to be, say, e to the power z, then sinh of z is omega. So where did I get omega? No, OK. So these are the definitions I have. So according to these definitions, for omega 0, when I have omega equals to 0, I have
is the notation on the right-hand side of this line consistent with that on the left-hand side of this line?
Sorry? Sorry?
Is the notation on the right-hand side of the line consistent with that on the left-hand side of the line? The z and the omega?
Oh, right. Yeah, no, it's not. But so, you know, we actually just start from here, okay? So exclude this guy, okay? So when omega is 0, then that implies that, you know, when omega is 0, then that implies that z is 0 and q is 1. So that's something that we'll use. Right. So using these two definitions, we can just now rewrite this equation as an, you know, as an algebraic equation. And this is a quadratic equation in Q. And so we can solve this. And we get two solutions. But using the fact that when we set omega equals to 0, we should get Q equals to 1. We discard one of the solutions, the one with the minus sign. And then we have sine hyperbolic inverse. Yeah.
Even when you set omega equal to 0 in that expression, you end up with an I for Q, not 1. Because if you just set, so you get 0 plus square root of minus 1, which is I.
Oh, I see, right. This should be a plus 1, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Okay, so. So from this expression, we now, if you take the inverse of this, then we get this. And you know, this is basically, right? And this guy is Q. And so if you replace the value of Q there, we get omega plus square root of omega plus 1. So this is arc sinh of omega. And you were right. This. Sorry?
This was consistent.
The left.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I left hand side. I completely missed what you were saying previously, because what you were saying, that why am I calling this z and why am I calling this omega, right? Yeah, sorry, this is, yeah. Sorry, I'm sorry. Yeah, not enough coffee. Also old age. okay, so it's kind of, you know, you play around these formulae, so it's nothing that difficult. Okay, so now you know how to derive this sort of, you know, exotic-looking inverse functions. So now I want to move on to the real the real topics of complex analysis, which involves differentiability. So now what we want to do is that we want to introduce a notion of complex differentiability. So for that, what we do is that we take some complex function whose real and imaginary part have first partial derivatives. And because they're functions of two variables, we know that the definition of the condition that the partial derivatives of of this function exist is that the partial derivative of u exists at the point x naught and y naught is that for small real numbers h and k, there exist two numbers a and b, and such that there is some remainder function that which has a property that that this thing goes to zero as h and k approach zero, right? So this is, so a is the derivative, is the partial derivative of u with respect to x, and b is the partial derivative of u with respect to y. So you may be more used to the notation where you actually have the division explicitly, but that only is kind of but that only works for single functions of single variable.
Here, this definition is implying that you are approaching x zero and y zero through the, let's say, y and x axis, right?
Right.
But in complex numbers, when you want to calculate a limit,
you have to all
independent of all the paths.
Exactly.
That you can In this case, if I define it this way, the differentiability of u or v, how does it also implies that f of z is differentiable if the limit exists independent of any path that I choose to?
So you're right. So we are going to impose this condition both on u and v. And then we are going to have an additional condition. And that's basically is, I'm not going to prove it, and I don't know right now, I can't, that it's independent of the path. But the additional condition would be the complex differentiability. Yes, Jake?
Yes, when you're doing this argument where you discard the minus sign, how come you are discarding q equals minus 1 in the solution? Shouldn't that also give you w equals 0? I think you have to keep the minus sign.
What?
Hang on. So when w is set to zero, what is the solution to sine hyperbolic z equals to is z is zero? Okay. And
you could identically have z equals I pi.
No, e to the power of 0 is going to give you q equals to 1.
Yes, but I mean, if you had z equals I pi, then you could also get another solution.
So if z is I pi, then q is minus 1. And Okay, I don't see why that's, you know, why that value is relevant for this, for this, for choosing the sign of this.
Well, I mean, I'm saying that you shouldn't be able to choose a sign. I'm saying that there's another solution.
Isn't it then the expression you get dependent on your choice for the value you're starting off with?
Sorry, I can't hear you.
Q minus Q inverse wouldn't be equal to 2W in that case, so you would derive a different formula on the next line
right.
by that choice of sign. So is that what you're saying? By your
yeah, I mean, if you start
of
off with it, if you have a different starting point, then you end up with a different expression.
Yeah.
Yes.
Doesn't it not matter, though, because of the multivalueness of the log function? That like
also, yes, that, yeah.
Like, in the formula you end up with, like...
Right, right. Yeah, there's a...
encapsulates that solution.
That's probably so you know we can write this in terms of the modulus of this plus you know the argument, and that ambiguity is probably taken care of by let's think about it.
Arc sinh is not a function in itself. You have to limit its domain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So we do the same here.
Right. What do you mean we do the same here?
As in, when we...
You do the same here only if you want to make it into a holomorphic function.
Yeah.
Which we'll see, you know.
So then why do you get rid of the minus sign?
Sorry?
So then why do you get rid of the minus sign?
Because that was an initial condition we set for the function, and it did not obey it if we included the minus sign.
Well, and with zero, set zero,
you'll end up with
minus. The minus sign, the initial condition is still obeyed.
Sorry?
Even if you have the minus sign, the initial condition should still be obeyed, right? Because you have another solution.
Not the z equals zero condition, though.
Well, not for z equals zero, but for z equals
like
pi, it works.
Yeah.
And the z sign is intersected.
So that's the thing. Isn't your expression then entirely dependent on the initial condition?
But didn't we just choose that initial condition because of...
Because of what?
Because of the sign shed. Oh, yeah, it's like a sinh function because you get...
Okay, let's talk about this after the class. I just want to get to complex differentiability, okay? So we write the same kind of expression for V. Because we also want V to have first partial derivatives. And some other remainder function, which has the same we take the same h and k.
So
they can be different, but you know we take in this case we take the same because we are going to combine them in the same function,
okay.
So that's why we are taking the same h and k. You know, they don't have to be.
Also, can we
for their definition they don't have to be for the fact that they have the differentiable. Yes.
Also, can we also do it like while holding, like taking a path through along the x line and then taking a path through along the y-line and proving in it and showing that any linear combination of that those paths would also satisfy.
Yeah, but this is more efficient notationally. So A is basically So this is just saying that, you know, U and V, their first partial derivatives exist. And then we say, if we demand that the function f of z, let's call this f because that which is made up by combining U and V, that that if it's complex differentiable, by which we mean if you take if z naught is a complex number and omega is another complex number, then there exists some other complex number e and some kind of remainder function, where omega now is e is alpha plus I beta, and omega we choose to be the complex combination of I and k, those two numbers that we, you know, the two small numbers. And if e exists as, you know, as the mod of this goes to zero, as omega goes to zero, then we say that the function f is, it's complex differentiable. Now, this is a complex equation, so we can take the real and imaginary part of it. And so if you take the real and imaginary part of this thing, then we basically get I'm just going to be notationally very a bit sloppy and write this, but what I mean is I found some typos here. Anyway, so there's a minus sign here from the fact that the two imaginary parts are multiplying, the real part of sigma, and V right. So now we, since you know these guys and that these expressions for U and these expressions for V, you know, comparing those two, the expressions that we derived for the existence of the first partial derivative tells us that, you know, this alpha must be both this as well as this, and beta is this as well as this at x0 and y0. So this is a consistency condition that we get, and so what we have derived is that for a function to be complex differentiable, its first derivatives must exist, and then it must satisfy also these equations, its real and imaginary part. And these equations are sometimes called conditions, sometimes called equations, and they are the famous Cauchy-Riemann equations. Okay. So there is a trick by which you can identify. So okay, functions which satisfy the Cauchy-Riemann equation at a particular point are known as analytic functions. And when they satisfy the Cauchy-Riemann equation in some open neighbor, a subset of the complex plane, they're called holomorphic functions. Some people called use the word analytic for both. So, you know, just when you're reading books, you'll come across analytics, holomorphic. A lot of times they mean the same thing. Yeah.
The way you did it shows that this is a necessary condition for differentiability, right? But there's this is also a sufficient condition for being complex differentiable, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. The Cauchy. So this and the fact that you know that its first derivative exists. Yes. And I think if a function is holomorphic, then it's all its derivatives exist and stuff like that. Okay. So there's a quick and easy way of spotting functions which are holomorphic. So okay, let me say again, write down the word. So analytic functions satisfy Cauchy-Riemann let's say conditions. And if an analytic function can be, if it's analytic in some open sets, then we say holomorphic.
When you say that they're analytic, you mean that
at a point.
Satisfy the conditions at least one point?
Right. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. I'm not. At one point, yes. I think if it's at all point, then it's then we call it a holomorphic function.
At one point,
something like that.
There's a theorem that says that if it's analytic in one point,
it's some open
neighborhood. In some open set center.
Right.
At one.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Open.
Right. So I'm going to write down some functions. F1 is x plus iy squared, x minus iy. Then say F2 is the real part of z. F3 is the imaginary part of square root of z. And F4 is z cubed. So can someone tell me which of these are holomorphic, which are not? Okay, we have one guy is saying just the fourth one. Okay. So okay, I haven't told you the trick by which you spot holomorphic functions, which is the following. The relationship between x and y and z bar is a linear relation, those are linear relationships. So you can invert them. So we have z is x plus iy, and z bar is x minus iy. And then, so using the chain rule, you can show very easily using these guys that, and on the other hand, using the chain rule, you can show that it's and then using these two expressions, you can now express the Cauchy-Riemann conditions as derivatives with respect to z and z bar. And if you do that, then this is what happens, is the Cauchy-Riemann conditions become this. That is, the derivative of f with respect to, let's not write the argument yet. Right? Which means that f is just a function of z. It's not a function of z bar. Right? And so now we can rewrite these guys in terms of z and z bar. So we have z squared z bar. The real of z is z plus z bar by 2 or minus, I forget. Anyway, the imaginary is, sorry?
Plus.
Plus, yes, thank you. Is something like this, right? So it's only one of the expressions doesn't have z bar, which is the fourth one, and therefore that's the, you know, that would be the holomorphic function. Okay, oh my God.
So, yes? Yeah? Sort of condition that you've written at the end here hold the necessary and sufficient properties of the original ring equations? But then if we find that this is the case for our function,
right.
Is it necessarily analytic?
So I guess you have to figure out, you know, if in the domain that you're looking at, it has its first derivative, then probably you're good to go. Or,
I think
sorry.
That is sufficient.
Sufficient, not?
I'm not quite sure, but I feel like it is sufficient. I think that was kind of
okay. Maybe for these sort of you know very subtle mathematical questions, you have to consult a book. I don't remember the details. Okay, so let's yes.
I'm a little bit confused. I guess what's the difference between all the partials existing and like behaving nicely and it being it having a first derivative, like a function having a first derivative.
So all you know, if it's if the first partial derivative exists, derivative exists, and it's satisfies that equation, then all its partial derivatives will exist.
To be analytic, it has to be infinitely different.
Because that's a theorem that follows from the fact that it's holomorphic, and it's you know that it's holomorphic.
So analytic is that it's like C infinity, not C one. Or that all its partials exist, not just
I mean, that's a consequence of analyticity, you know.
You can write it as a Taylor expansion, in
other words, or a complex function. Exactly. So, OK, so let's, more interesting stuff, at least for me, is to talk about, so holomorphicity has geometric interpretation. So for example, suppose we have a two-dimensional vector t, and when I write, I always have the vector sign as an underbar, which is, I guess, the minority convention. Most people have something over that and an arrow. So anyway. So let's take the real and imaginary part of a complex function and make a two-dimensional vector. Then you can verify that the Cauchy-Riemann equation, you know, imply that it's that the its divergence and curl free. By this, I mean the two-dimensional divergence and the curl. Right. And then another interesting, nice consequence of Cauchy-Riemann equation is that if you look at the complex plane, if you look at the lines of constant u's and v's, then basically they are orthogonal to each other. So they basically give you something like this. So these are lines of constant u's and these are lines of constant v's. And to see that, what you have to do is that take the gradient of u and the gradient of v, and then So the dot product between these two guys is and then use the Cauchy-Riemann equations in one of these factors to convert. So for example, if you use this to change this one, you change this guy, then you get, and over here you change this guy. And because there's a minus sign coming from here, this will go to 0. And similarly, you can show that the length of these vectors. So you know, what is the gradient of u? The gradient of u is, it's a vector which is perpendicular, unit vector, it's a vector perpendicular to, you know, to this curve, and it tells you how this curve changes. And you can show that this is actually equal to this. So there are all these very nice geometrical interpretation. So right. So in some sense, you can use the u's and v's as some kind of, you know, curvilinear coordinate system. And you can think of all holomorphic functions as a map from the complex plane to itself. The map may not be a well-behaved map on all of the complex plane, but at least, you know, it'll map some, you know, open region of the complex plane to itself, to another open region in complex on the complex plane. So, so for example, let's consider two complex variables, omega and z. So this is a holomorphic function, right? Z is a holomorphic function of omega, right? And then, how should I do this? Right. Okay, so so suppose we have another holomorphic function, f of z. And if you make this change of variable, then we have some, you know, we write it like this. Then if I express this in terms of as a function of omega, it'll be a different function, right? Now this guy will have some real and imaginary part. So f of z will have some real and imaginary part, say u x comma y plus I v x comma y. And this guy, g of omega, will also have a real and imaginary part, which is I write by capital U, x and y capital, I v x and y, where by big X and Y, I mean omega has a real part and an imaginary part. Now, since both of these functions are holomorphic functions, the local relationships that we derive between the gradient of U and the gradient of V up there holds both for this guys and this guy, for both the small UVs and the big UVs. So in some sense, well, not in some sense, in the precise sense, you know, this function, say, describes some kind of a, you know, coordinate system. And this function G describes some other kind of coordinate system, say. And the and you know, expressing, you know, this change of variable. So what is important is that this change of variable will preserve, since it preserves those relationships, if you have, say, two very little vectors over here, then they will get mapped onto some very two little vectors over here. But the angle between them, it will, if it was 90 degrees here, will still be 90 degrees over here. So I'm showing, so this is, say, the constant lines of U's, and this is the constant lines of V's. And these are the constant lines of big U's and constant lines of big V's. So I'm expressing this statement in terms of, you know, the constant lines of U's and V's. But sometimes this, the fact that, you know, this map preserves the angles between curves locally is expressed by saying that small triangles, so this is a very small triangle, get mapped to small triangles, similar triangles under this transformation. And this sort of map is called a conformal transformation or a conformal map. And I'm sure you've seen many examples of conformal map in your undergraduate course on complex analysis. Have you? Anyways. You know, how you basically, you know, there's a whole list of exercises where you try to map the upper half plane into a disk. You have to guess what function, variable transformation you have to use to be able to do that. Okay. But the conformal map is also, you know, this is something, it's a bread and butter of string theory. You know, in some sense, you know, the string theory is invariant under the conformal map. And the thing is that, you know, you can think of any old variable change of variable, right? This could be, it just has to be, you know, holomorphic. So, you know, you just invent something and you have a, you know, so for string theory to have this invariance means that it has, anyway, I won't go there. It has a large symmetry. Okay? Sorry, I'm running way behind. So, I was going to do harmonic functions, but I'm just going to skip it. So, you can show that given a holomorphic functions, its real and imaginary part satisfy two-dimensional Laplace's equation. And that's just a very simple consequence of Cauchy-Riemann equation. So, you know, and because of the conformal, you know, properties of the conformal map, if you find one solution to the Cauchy, to Laplace's, so if you find one solution to Laplace's equation, by using the Cauchy-Riemann equation, you can find its it's conjugate. So if you have u, by solving those equations, you can find v. So thus, you can find a holomorphic function for every solution of the two-dimensional Laplace's equation. So once you've found a holomorphic function, you can do all kinds of conformal transformation on that and find a whole, like, infinite number of and solutions to Laplace's equation, because all the all the holomorphic transformations that you do will generate new solutions of Laplace's equation, right? So, you know, this is extremely powerful. So, you know, in some sense, two-dimensional electrostatics is solved because of complex analysis. You know, it's too bad we don't live in two dimensions. we wouldn't be able to eat here. We wouldn't even have brains, right? Because, you know, in brains, you need a three dimensions to have enough connections between the neurons, right? Anyway, those problems aside, you know, it's a pity that we don't live in there. Have you guys read Flatland? Okay, so, you know, there's a famous book about two-dimensional creatures and how they view three-dimensional, you know, objects passing through their world, things like that. Okay, so I mentioned something about if you have the if you're given the real part of a harmonic function, sorry, of a holomorphic function, you can find the imaginary part of the holomorphic function by solving the Cauchy-Riemann equations. And there's an example in my lecture notes. I'm not going to go through that. You can just, you know, this is not the most efficient way of finding the harmonic. U and Vs are called harmonic conjugates, by the way. This is not the most efficient way of finding the harmonic conjugate. I found in some book there's some other more sophisticated method, but, you know, but for the purpose of, for conceptual, you know, for conceptual purposes, you know, this is good enough. Okay. So I really want to just start on integrations of complex functions, and so the most important integrations of complex functions turn out to be line integrals. Although, you know, we talk about the complex plane, the most useful integrals are not area integrals, but line integrals. However, having said that, you know, in physics, often you'd have to, if you're thinking about, say, some theory defined on a complex plane or something, then you'd have to do an area integral because action, for example, is a, you know, it's an integral over all space-time, right? So, so we'll often need to consider integrals of this form where gamma is a So gamma is a curve. It's a curve on the complex plane which doesn't intersect itself. So, you know, so gamma is a curve which is, say, something looks like this, not, say, like this. So in other words, so gamma is called a contour, and it's some map from some, so A and B are real numbers, this is some segment of the real line to some open set in the complex plane. So So let's call this parameter t. So t takes its value from a to b. Then this integral is defined in the following way. So the integral over gamma is defined to be, so this is a definition, the integral from a to b of the complex function evaluated along the curve, and then the derivative of that curve with respect to t, the parameter, and this dt. So this is the definition of a contour integral. So this is what we call a contour integral. So let's quickly do an example. An example which is basically can be all of complex analysis can be reduced to. By the way, this is that definition of the contour integral is makes sure that if you reparametrize your curve, so if you want to say, okay, I'm not going to parametrize my curve by t, but by some other variable s, which is a function of t, but such that s increases as t increases, so you don't change the direction in which s changes, then you can re-express the integral in terms of integral over s, and the value of this integral will not change. So it's invariant under reparametrization, right? Okay, so let's consider a circle of radius r and some function f of z, which is z to the power n. And then, so this is our gamma. So here we are considering a contour where a and b are the same point. So it's a, yes, Sal?
I just need one. Will it be always or sometimes possible to find an affine parameter?
What do you mean by affine?
Like, in the sense that the values of the function scale as the values of the parameter. There's a direct linear relationship. Like when we're doing the finding out the geodesic equation in general,
right, right. Yeah.
You define an affine parameter that simplifies your Lagrangian.
Right, right.
So can we do something like that for this?
I'm not sure. I don't think so, but.
Okay.
But
depending on your function, you can always parameterize to make the integration easier. That's what it does.
Yeah.
You
can
the
affine parameterization slightly.
If you parameterize with arc length, you just simplify the derivative.
Oh, I see. Right. I see. Okay. Okay. So that function, you mean this guy? Simplify
yeah.
This guy. Yes, I'm sure you. That seems plausible. Yes.
The arc length parameterization makes the derivative go to one.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think that's what we do here, right? Right. And I think that in the usual parameterization of the circle, that's what we do. Yeah. Okay, so we are taking A and B to be the same point. Then, so sometimes, when A and B are the same point, we denote those integrals by this O. but with the point that we are doing the integral around in the counterclockwise direction. So this is, so what is this, f of z, d of z? So to do this, of course, as you know, Saab said, we have to parametrize our circle. And we parametrize our circle as r e to the power I t, right? So when you do this, you,
your n is an integer?
N is an integer, yes. So basically, if you do this, then your integral becomes an integral from 0 to 2 pi. And then r e to the power I n t I times r e to the power I t dt. So this gives us, since the integral does not depend on r, we can factor this out. And so this is sorry? So this is 2 pi I if n is minus 1, 0 otherwise. And this is an extremely important result, the fact that, so what is extremely important is the fact that this is an often used result.
If n is equal to negative 2.
Then you basically, because of the exponential function and because it's 0 to pi, 2 pi, you get 0. It's only when n is minus 1, so this is just a constant, you're just,
yeah.
Okay. So, so in the last 7 minutes, I'm gonna just mention the fundamental theorem of calculus as it applies to complex variables. It's really the fundamental theorem of calculus, which is always that's where the tire hits the road, or the integrals hit the differentials. Adam meets Eve. Yeah, let's not carry on along those directions. So suppose U is some open subset of the complex plane, and there is a non-self-intersecting curve, gamma. And such curves are sometimes called, I think, Jordan curves, because some guy named Jordan was involved in defining them. Was it the physicist Jordan? I don't know. Sorry? Do you know that?
Probably the mathematician.
Sorry?
The mathematician, I suppose.
Oh, I guess he was from the previous, from the 19th century, right?
Yeah.
Right. Because it's
same
not
as Jordan's lemma, I guess.
Oh, I see. Not Pascal Jordan, I guess. So that's a different Jordan. Sorry, I know the physicists. I don't know the mathematicians. So, Yeah, so the in some, and suppose that F is some, I think it has to be holomorphic, such that the derivative of F is equal to the function that we are trying to integrate.
You choose an orientation, right?
I did, yes.
Positively oriented. Yeah.
We could just have a winding number as well.
Then it wouldn't be a self-interacting intersect, wouldn't be non-self-intersecting, right?
Yes, and he said just like it depends on the way you go around.
Yeah, but winding number is a slightly different concept. When you're in two dimensions, if you have a curve which has a winding number of more than one, then you're necessarily saying that it's intersecting itself.
Okay.
Right, so.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, so this is not a one, yeah. Okay, anyway, so then the fundamental theorem calculus says that the integral of along this curve is given by F evaluated at the end of this curve's and so if F is a continuous function, that means its first derivative exists. Then if you take this gamma, say to be a closed loop, then it follows that this thing will give you zero. And in fact, we have seen an example where this fails, where F is 1 over Z, and this is 2 pi I. And this is related to the fact that F, which we call the antiderivative, big F, which we call the antiderivative of small f, in this case is not a continuous function. It is, in fact, the log function, which we know to be multivalued. And okay. So in the last 1 minute, I'm going to prove the Cauchy theorem. I'm kidding. I'm just going to... starting from next class, I'll start with the Cauchy's integral theorem. I won't prove the most general one. I'll prove a more, restricted version of it, because the general one is a bit more fiddly and will take more time. But let me just write down what the theorem is. And it says that... if U is some simply connected region of the complex plane, and gamma is some closed loop, non-self intersecting closed loop in U, and F of Z is holomorphic in U, then the integral of F of Z on this thing is zero. Okay, so we'll discuss that next time.